This lesson is on how you build and construct a project team. How do you know you're actually ready for a project team is actually a really good place to start. A lot of times projects start with 10 or 15 or 20 people in a room, and because of that there's so many voices, there's so many things going on that everybody sort of just gets discombobulated very quickly. So what we're actually going to walk through is how you should know that your particular project or your sort of thing you're working on is ready for a project team. As an individual, you know you're ready for a project team if you've reached the limits of what you can do on your own. And there are sort of three criteria that we evaluate for in terms of when you've reached your limits. The first one is technically. Technically, you cannot code in a certain language, or you do not have the knowledge of how a database works or a mobile app works. You know, you basically don't have sort of those specialized skills that you sort of really need to carry off your project goals. We differentiate that from infrastructurally, okay? Infrastructurally, you know you've reached your limits when you have things like you can't get server space from your university, or you have so much data or so many projects going on or so many things going on that your university or the group you're working with just can't support it anymore. Okay? This is very common and is very important, particularly for people who are on what we call low resource campuses. So small liberal arts colleges, HBCUs, things like that. You know, where you are not in a university R1 school with a computer science department and a massive OIT group. That's when you know you need more infrastructure support. But also you know you've reached your limits as an individual intellectually. If your project sort of gets to a point where you've exacerbated or sort of gone through all of your core knowledge about a particular topic or subject, or you reach an area of your project where you're not a specialist in that theory or that person or that group. So this happens a lot with digital humanities projects when they sort of take their project to the side by doing things like adding in political theory or, you know, adding a new group of people or adding a new language or subject basis or country basis. So how do you know your team is ready for more members? So if we've already identified that you as an individual sort of have reached your limits technically, infrastructurally, or intellectually, how do you know when you already have a team that's working well that you may need a couple more people on your team? This is a key one. The current team you have cannot support the deliverables you've agreed to for your project. So this is quite common in projects where they think, for example, or they say, I'm going to build a mobile app to do this. But the members of their team, even though they thought they knew how to build a mobile app when they put in their grant or they started building their project, in fact get 6 months or 9 months or even 2 years into a project, and they realize that they really don't actually know how to do this or it's beyond their skill set. So adding another team member can be really good to sort of respond to the fact that you're struggling with a deliverable, okay? And sometimes this is as simple as you just need a super specialized skill. So if you're interested in 3D models, you know, and your university does great work in 3D models, but then you have a staff member who leaves, you then have to go find a new team member to replace that skill set. So that's why at the beginning of class, I gave you this little post-it to put your name on and sort of list your skill that you could bring to a project team. This is a really good exercise when you first meet with a project team to have everyone put up their one skill that they are super great at so that you guys can figure out how to best use that person. Okay? So inevitably for me, when we end up in project skill conversations, everybody wants me to run their lives because I could pretty much, you know, run a foreign country or even the United States of America if I had enough energy, time, and cared about politics. Because I'm really good at organization. I'm good at making people move in the same direction in a logical, orderly, structured fashion. So knowing what your sort of skills are you can bring to a project. So what I want to show you guys is the optimal matrix for staffing a project team in digital humanities. And this is familiar to some people who've heard us give this spiel for the Digital Humanities Incubator that we run here at Maryland. When we talk about, you know, really great, rich digital humanities projects, these are the common staffers they have involved. a project director or manager, so usually somebody that's like me who, you know, helps organize things, who helps, you know, make sure meetings happen, who makes sure you turn in things on deadline, you know, make sure you hire your staff, you know, knows who to do things with. A subject researcher, so who's the humanist who actually has that sort of core question? You know, oftentimes these are faculty who are coming to you with an idea, or this is even your personal project that you're sort of working on. Like, you have this subject expertise and subject knowledge that you want to sort of bring to the project. Where possible, you want somebody that's a public humanities specialist. And when I say that, I don't necessarily mean somebody who specifically specializes in public history or things like that, but you want someone who's attuned to the needs of the public. So this is a role that could be fulfilled by a librarian. This is a role that could be filled by a museum professional. This is a role that could be fulfilled by somebody doing educational training and outreach for your group. Okay, this is somebody who's attuned to how others from the outside would be engaging with your project. Most digital humanities projects, particularly when you get to the advanced digital humanities level where you're writing algorithms and writing new softwares and building things, also have a computational researcher. Somebody who is in charge of the computer development side of the project, who may bring with them their students, may bring with them other colleagues, but somebody who's really attuned to the technical choices that are being made and sort of where you're going with your technology. So here at MIT, we have an assistant director that is specifically for research and development, and he has a team of people that work with him, another faculty member, actually two more staff members, some graduate students. His job, part of his job, is to make sure they're all following best practices and standards and following all of the sort of computational protocols so that our software doesn't fall flat on its face when we get ready to release it. This often is a role for schools with low resources that can be fulfilled by an OIT person or, you know, sort of a technical specialist. So Jason Farman, who was at the Graduate Student Networking event last night, is a specialist in mobile technologies and locative technologies. He would fill some of that role if you were building a mobile app. You know, he can do that sort of work. This is also, by the way, where graduate students and undergraduates also come into play. You know, Andy's got CS students that are getting their, you know, master's degrees who want to work with him. That's a role that they play in an optimal project. And you also have an information specialist. This, again, is a role that's usually filled by a librarian, but also could be filled by an archivist or somebody who specializes in sort of, you know, library and information science, you know, archiving, museums, those sorts of things. This is a person who's going to do things like pay attention to your data curation and preservation and sustainability. The best digital humanities projects that exist right now have people filling all of these roles. But I want to be clear, it's not always five separate individuals. Oftentimes, there are people who fill multiple roles. So you could be the subject researcher with the question and also be directing the project. You could be the subject researcher librarian who is also doing the information science piece. Okay? So what are the types of things that these individual roles do? The job of a project director, and by director I mean the person ultimately who came up with the question with the original vision or the original provocation, their job is intellectual and strategic leadership. Okay? The reason why I differentiate between intellectual leadership and strategic leadership is this. Intellectual leaders often want to push for, they're focused on the disciplinary questions. They're focused on being or answering questions in English or history or, you know, Neil is, for example, is focused on Shelley Godwin. He's a Shelley scholar. He wants to push the questions we ask about Shelley. In that, intellectualism is different from his strategic stuff, where it's about him thinking about, you know, who do we have as partners? How do we get his work out there? How do we, you know, address and get that profile being built, okay? The key element of a project director is that they have a vision of what the project can be, that they share with the rest of the team, and that they can build with the rest of the team. Oftentimes, on the administrative side of a project, you also have an associate or assistant director. If you haven't noticed and done the count, MIT has crazy five directors, actually six with our business manager, partly because some of us do this sort of development work and outreach work, on different sides of the equation. So if you use Mithun as an example, Travis Brown is our director for research and development. He focuses on development and outreach having to do with the computational technologies. I'm an assistant director who focuses on the humanities content. So I help us identify projects and partnerships and help us, you know, get humanists getting their projects moving. So teaching a class like this is part of my mandate and responsibilities. Same thing with Matt and Trevor, who you saw yesterday. You know, Trevor is a specialist who works in libraries. So his mandate is to develop library-based projects and do outreach to library communities. You don't necessarily have to have these people, but you do have to have someone on your team whose job it is to pay attention to how the project is working and running beyond the day-to-day of sort of, you know, checking off tasks. So what about technical staff? Everybody always wants to know how you get technical people on your project. I want to sort of give you a couple of different snapshots of the types of technical people you can have on your project. The first one is a lead programmer of some sort. This is the person who is charged with making sure that the project follows all of the best practices and rules in computer science. Okay, so this is the person who makes sure you do things like using the right file formats and making sure your code isn't buggy and crappy when you put it out. They're also usually the person that supervises all of the other people that are doing code and technology. Okay, so in Myth's case, our lead programmer and our assistant director for computer science research and development are the same exact person, just with a little bit of changes in how he talks to people depending on which role he's playing. So in his programmer role, he's actually checking their code and looking at things every day. In his more strategic development role, he's doing things like looking for new technologies that Myth should be using or making recommendations about the things that we should be doing. And this is important for projects when we sort of step back from the infrastructure level. This is important for projects that are intending to be projects that last for 10 or 20 years or projects where you have multiple institutions at play. Because every institution is going to have a different idea of the technologies they want to use and the things they want to follow. So when you have a lead programmer or somebody, you know, that's specifically about the vision of the technology, it means you get consistency, okay? Their job is to ensure that no matter who's doing the developing or no matter what's being done, there is consistency in how you code certain things, okay? But everybody likes the guy that's in the corner or the girl that's in the corner who, like, you know, looks like the typical nerd and, you know, has peripherals stuck to them all day long. Most projects also have straight-up programmers who all they are interested in is a specific sort of code language that they know, and they're going to hack it, break it, build it in that particular language. So some of you guys have talked about GIS. This is where coders and programmers build new apps and geographic information systems, and they specialize in the computer languages that help you do that. Matt Jockers, who's teaching this cycle, is a specialist in R, which is a language that you use with topic modeling usually. So there are a multitude of computer science languages that are out there. You have to find the right person who knows the right language for your project. Okay? Yes?
So if you're not great at coding and how do you know which code would be the best and which language would be the best for your project? And say I'm at a very, very small school where I don't even.
So there are two ways to identify which sort of languages or which sort of genres of computer science you should be in. The first way to do it that's really quickly is find a project that does the types of things you want yours to do, and you basically walk it into your OIT or your computer science department and you say, I need you to look at this and tell me what language it's working in, what it works like on the back end. Okay? Any OIT computer hacker, coder, programmer that your university hires should be able to look at the code with a software or a site and will tell you what version it is, what language it is. All of that is documentation that's hidden behind the scenes. And if we have time at some point, I can also show you guys how you can reveal that in, like, Firefox, for example. Yeah.
Just to comment about that, because I'm at a small liberal arts college as well, and we do have computer science department.
But again, this is.
I just put a call out and said, this is the kind of thing I'm interested in. If there are any students who can get me from point A to point B in terms of the computer language or what have you, because I was working with film, I get this great kid. He came to my door. We talked about it. I said, this is what I want. And he said, this is what I can do. And it was really cool. But I just, put it out there. Who can make this happen?
Yeah.
Just a quick suggestion. If you find a project similar to yours, the programmers are usually consulting workers who will also work on your project, right? So we found a project that was very similar to ours, and one of the programmers for that project is also working with us.
And you can hire... Yeah, you can hire people that specialize in this. So Tim Sherratt, who is the real faces of Australia, Invisible Australia, actually has an entire consulting business where you can hire Tim Sherratt to build stuff for you, as does Scott Weingart at Indiana, who is great at he's in library and information science there, who's also building. You can do the same thing with the Center for History and New Media. If you want to build Omeka repositories, you can hire them to build for you.
In terms of our institutions,
They are. What you have to realize in terms of cost is, it depends on the types of things you want to build, how expensive you get. So if you are from a low resource institution and you know money is going to be an issue or access to things are going to be an issue, one of the things that we recommend is you find a partner who has a stronger reputation in the thing that you need. So don't try and do it on your own if you're a small, tiny college. For example, I have a partnership with Illinois College. I have a former colleague who were working on a project together where, Illinois College is like four buildings in the middle of Illinois. It's a lovely campus, but the types of things he wants to do, there's just no resources for. There's no support. They don't even have digital humanities even as a word that they use, much less something he could build there. And so he wrote me an email and said, hey, I'm going to be in D.C. Can we talk about the fact that I want to do this project with you? Let's do that. You can cold call the people that do the types of work you want to do and say, will you let us, let me have a conversation. We might be interested in putting in a grant with you or hiring with you. The thing that I will say about this hiring thing, though, is to always make sure that at the end of the day, you are checking to make sure that they're following best practices and standards. So when we hire new programmers, we ask for things like examples of the code that they've built, pointers to all of the sites that they've done. We ask for recommendations for people that they have built for previously, so not just their former bosses, but if they worked on code for a project, we'll call up the project director and say, tell us what it was like dealing with that person. What did they have to say? It's a really good way to know the person and find out, not just sort of the authorized version from their former employer, but also how they are to work with on a project. And then the other staff that you always have on a project like this or in any sort of project is always someone dealing with your systems issues. So hardware, software, systems config. This is the person who does things like, make sure you have your computers up and running, email, server space. Most frequently, this is the person where if you work in things like WordPress or Drupal or Omeka, they're the person who does that new install for you. So before you can start building, they have to create user accounts and things like that. This most frequently is the role served by IT departments on campuses. And any IT campus, any IT department on any campus in the United States has a systems administrator somewhere because every university has a website. And if you have a website, you have an IT person somewhere. All right. So I wanted to break down a little bit the types of programmers that you can have working on your project. You can have people that work in user experience. So somebody define for me user experience. I know somebody mentioned it yesterday in there. Yes, user experience.
Basically how easy it is to use the final product, whether it be an app or a site or you had yesterday like an event, right?
A
conference. For a website or an app, it's usually a lot to do with interface design, right? Like how do people navigate through it, the colors, the overall.
Okay. What about front end? Does anybody know what a front end programmer does? Yeah.
That'd be graphics. A lot of what the website look. What does the homepage look like? Where are the menus? Where do they navigate to? Is it easy to click back to the page you were on before?
Great. So a front end person also is the person who oftentimes is worried about things like how you're getting the data and how it looks on the page. So this is the person where if you're building a mobile app, for example, who's really concerned about the data that they get to the mobile app and like what format it's in and how it gets treated in the actual interface. So how many times have you guys loaded a website and there's like a section of the site missing? That's a front end issue, okay? That means something went wrong between when the data was sent from the back end and what you get in the front end, okay? You also, though, have programmers who do middleware. Middleware is exactly that. It's stuff that works between the front end that everybody sees and the back end that's usually, you know, something everybody thinks is super scary. They're the ones who are interested in the pathways between the back end where all the data is in that raw format that's super ugly that nobody wants to look at and the pretty version in the front, okay? Middleware designers often are the people that are also doing things like figuring out how you ship large amounts of data to libraries or around different institutions and different systems, okay? They're interested in the transit issue is how I always think of it. And I'm sure our computer science would love to argue with me about all these definitions, but for humanists, these are the ones we're going to stick to. Backend. Backend is exactly what it sounds like. Backend is the sort of infrastructural pieces that make everything hum and run and work together. These are the people that are focused on things like how the data is stored in your repository or how the code runs something. So how many times have you guys gone to load a website and the website takes forever to load? Almost always, that means there's something crappy in the back end that makes it really, really slow. Or how many times have you loaded a website and the data looks kind of weird and funky? That's usually a back-end error. There's something going on in the transformations when it's leaving the repository that it just doesn't really work, okay? And then you have people that work in custom systems, mobile devices. And I want to distinguish here for you guys between iOS and Android. So iOS is the Mac platform, anybody that uses an iPhone, and Android is the free open source Google platform. Most programmers do not program in both, okay? Most of them have either one or the other that they like to program in. So when you go to hire somebody or you go to talk to people about mobile devices, one of the first questions you should ask is, do you build an iOS? Do you build an Android? When you find good programmers, they almost always will program in both, okay? Those are the great people because it means you can put the same content out in both platforms with no problems. Okay? Yeah.
There is also one category that at least we've had trouble finding people, and that's accessibility, especially if you want your end product to be disability accessible for people with hearing and vision impaired. We have, with the Journal of Interactive Technology and Pedagogy, we've had a real struggle like making it accessible in all definitions of that word.
And we're actually going to talk about that when we get to the sort of public website piece. But a good user experience person and a good front-end person should be trained in at least the minimum W3C standards of accessibility. So W3C is the universal world global standard for accessibility. So things like when you have a photo that it's been commented what the photo is in the site, or when you have audio files that there's a textual element so that somebody who's using a screen reader or somebody that's using a Braille device knows that there should have been an audio file there. Good UE people at the front end should all have that standard. We have a graphic designer who works part-time for all of Myth. She runs an entire business that half of her business is doing this sort of accessibility consulting and design work. Other questions about technical specialists before I move on?
Again, being Canadian, I don't know quite exactly what's available in the U.S., but I know the Canadian National Institute for the Blind has people who specialize in web accessibility, and who basically, I think you can you submit your, if you want them to approve it, you submit your site to them, and they will tell you what to change. So there may be something similar.
And there are tools that you can use to run these sorts of checks. So there are tools out there that will do these sorts of compliance checks. When you're at a larger institution, your OIT, your technology division, should have a compliance check on anything you put out. So they should do this for you. If they're at all, you know, paying attention to their game, they should. All right. So let's talk about visual outreach, the visual component of staffing. Almost everyone at some point or another needs some sort of graphic design work. That is logos, brochures, mailings. Oftentimes, graphic designers get involved, too, on websites. So doing things like custom themes, you know, for Drupal or WordPress, or custom colors. We use a graphic designer here at Myth for half of the work, so the stuff that is externally funded. And then she, if she has time, does it. If not, we roll it down actually to one of our graduate students who does work as well as a graduate student. This doesn't have to be a specific person, but it needs to be somebody who is attuned to visual elements in both print and digital form, okay? You'd be amazed at the number of people who do things like put black logos on black backgrounds or white logos on light gray backgrounds. That's super hard to see. When somebody goes to capture your site, it's super messy. You know, somebody paying attention to how appealing this is visually. And when we get to the section on sort of building your first website, we'll talk a little bit about what you want to avoid when you do that. And almost everyone has some sort of website designer. This is the person who puts in content management systems, so things like Drupal or WordPress. This is also the person who potentially builds a custom site for you if you want it running with HTML and CSS and PHP type things. This is also, in our case, somebody who does all of our maintenance for our center stuff. So every time we've got to add new projects or every time we have to, you know, throw up something new. So they did the DHWI site. They handle, our website designer also handles things like our social media and Twitter feeds, making sure that we have all the URLs and all the Twitter hashtags and everything and that we're actually getting that data back.
Do you have a web designer just for
me? We have a graduate student that's 20 hours a week. All of our visual outreach stuff is done on one full-time person. It's a 20-hour graduate student and a 20-hour graphic designer. And that's for 18 current projects, plus whatever's in the back-end hopper that hasn't quite made it into external funding yet. And you always have a project management person. This is the details person who handles all the logistics and meeting planning and tracking of deliverables. I'm sure it would seem like, after spending 24 hours listening to me, that I am a project manager. I'm actually not. I hate nothing more than checking off what people have done. It drives me insane. It is the quickest way to, like, make me crazy. But I like all the logistical stuff. So basically, what we do here at Myth is we actually use a tool that does the day-to-day tracking. So I assign everything. And then we use a tool that we're going to show you guys later today, and it tells me when somebody's finished something, and they get to comment and tell me what they're doing next. Because there's nothing more that I hate than having to meet with somebody every morning to see what they did the day before. And if you get lucky, you have some sort of business person. Most centers have a dedicated business person, but on individual projects, this is where you can rely on your department or your university. This is the person who does things like puts in the financial reports to NEH or to your funder, who does the hiring if you have to hire a new staff. This is also the person who does things like balancing your books for your grants or your projects to make sure you're not over or underspending. Most of you guys at this stage of the game are going to rely on your departments or, you know, in the case of the library, you know, your library administration. I encourage you, even if you're running a project independently, to make sure you track all of your financial information, regardless of whether you have internal or external funding. Your time is money, and so you should keep an accounting of how much time you spend doing stuff, because you can turn that into a dollar figure to show your commitment to your project. For those of you that are at low resource centers in particular, the financial thing is a big deal because you don't have a lot of money. It doesn't go very far. And they're going to want to know how you spent every penny of it and what the response was to them spending their dollar. For those of you guys who are focusing on sort of teaching projects or training projects, most of these sorts of positions or the educational specialist positions are positions that get fulfilled by you as an instructor or a faculty member. It also can get fulfilled by a graduate student who, you know, is teaching a class for you or is doing special stuff. If you're planning on running a curriculum, so for undergraduate or graduate students, a curriculum designer or an educational specialist who does training is super helpful when you're getting things up and running, because they're going to know things like how to write learning outcomes, how to write the campus proposal to get your, you know, undergraduate degree approved or your graduate degree approved. I personally am a big fan of educational specialists because there's nothing for me that is harder than like trying to go through and making sure all of the readings have gotten aligned and assigned the right ways. If you have somebody that does this sort of educational specialist stuff, they're going to tell you what the best platform is to get things to students or the way students want to engage with it. So what about, you know, how do you know how many people you should have and sort of what percentages they should be? So types of staffing. Most projects have either full-time or part-time or some sort of combination of the two. So a 100% person is 40 hours a week. You usually, when you're thinking about these types of staffing, assume 52 weeks a year of productivity. You hope. But then everybody gets vacation time and everybody gets vacation time. Everybody loses the weeks of December around Christmas and New Year's. Most projects when they first start out, and even most projects here at Myth, do not run on 100% staff. They run on less than 100%. So somebody who has a project as part of their responsibilities that they're already doing something else. The reason why we're highlighting the difference between dedicated or sort of permanent staff and joint or multi-part staff is it's going to come back to you guys in the budget section. When we talk about how do you know somebody is, you build them out for more than 100%, or how do you know when somebody can't take on another project? So the type of staffing that you choose affects your capacity and your obligations. The more part-time staff on the project, the more coordination is required. So how many of you guys ever tried to schedule a meeting with like 15 people? You all giggle and laugh. Somebody's got to be in charge of getting that meeting scheduled. The more part-time people you have who aren't in the same space all the time, the more complex it gets. Particularly when you're dealing with faculty who are up for tenure and promotion, where they may be really busy doing dossiers, or staff that are on leave, so maternity leave or paternity leave. The more people you have that have multiple responsibilities or things going on, the more one person has to be paying attention. And that's what we call the split attention problem, which is in any given project, at any given moment, no matter who's talking about it, you probably have 18 to 30 things to do that are unrelated to your project or to what you're doing. And that includes you as the person running it. So you want to think about how do you get everybody in the same room, focused on the same thing. Here at Myth, we do that by no meeting is longer than 45 minutes. We walk in with an agenda and a list of things we got to get done. And we leave the room in 45 minutes and it better be done. And if it ain't done, we schedule the next meeting before we've even left the first one. It's kind of mean to people, but you find everybody's a lot more willing to get stuff done if they know when you come in that you're going to be serious, get it done, and if you get done early, they get to go have 15 minutes to themselves before their next meeting or their next conversation. No one project staff member can do everything. When projects start out, usually, they start out with you doing all of it. You know, managing yourself, having the humanities content, usually playing with the code if you're a coder. The reality is no one person can do anything, and that's why you really do need a team. Particularly digital humanities, where the technology changes anywhere from 6 months to 3 months to 2 weeks even. Technology changes fast, so it helps to have more people paying attention to what's going on. The key element in terms of constructing your project team is that you need to understand each other's roles and responsibilities. So how many of you guys have been in a partnership or a conversation and you find out that the person you're depending on is leaving for 2 weeks or, you know, has sick leave or something happens and they're gone for a month and you can't find their files or there's no email track or there's, you know, my favorite was yesterday when we went to go let Richard into the lab and the person we were relying on apparently took a vacation day and didn't think to email me and say, I'm taking a vacation day. Here's your contact you should call to get into the room we need. You know, things like that happen. So it's important to know who's responsible for what, you know, what they're supposed to be doing, and where they keep all the pertinent information on your project. The phrase that I use that Simon used to laugh about, and everyone here now still does, is if you get hit by a bus, how would your project or your team continue without you? So we're going to talk about anal retentive file organizational systems and a few other things in a little while. Everybody laughs. But if I would have died over Christmas, there was a DHWI folder on my desk that had everything they needed in it to run DHWI. Because you never know.